This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute recently put out the announcement of the completion of a lengthy, and we say lengthy because it was over a number of years, a study of how local governments include schools as well as parks and city halls, town halls and the like are able to pay for the services and provide the services to Hoosiers and in turn how they're getting their money to be able to pay for all of those services that they offer. And the team that put up together this independent fiscal analysis is with us, at least the leader of the team is with us, Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer. And Professor DeBoer, thank you for, as always, for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. Good to be with you again.
Thanks for being with us, because this is a very interesting situation. I know that because we are still dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, we can blame it for a lot of things. We can't blame it for this particular report, because you worked on it for so long with your colleagues, but you do have some interesting notes that you put into it that have something to do with the effects of the pandemic on local government. Tell us first about how the entire, which is now 46 pages in length, all came together for the study.
Yeah, it did get longer than I thought it would. And the data was just singing to me, Chris. What can I tell you?
Well, you're going back from to 2002, I guess, and there's a reason that you went back then, right?
That's right. Well, first of all, what we're trying to measure here is what I call a capacity cost index, and we're trying to come up with a comparison of the revenue-raising ability of local governments to the costs they face to deliver services to their population. And this is a measure that tries to be apart from any of the individual decisions that local governments make. So look at the sort of foundational economic and demographic situation for each of the county's local governments or for all of the counties in Indiana. We looked at 2002 and 2018, because over that period of time, the state of Indiana changed just about every major feature of local government budgeting and finance. We did a vast reform of our property tax. We reformed our local income taxes. We reform our state school funding formula every budget year. And amazingly, we even reformed the road funding formula from the state. And so one of the things we wanted to do was to compare 2002 to 2018, before all the reforms started and after all the reforms were in place, to see how those changes affected local governments.
What are some of the important points that I guess the talking points that would go into like an executive summary? You referred to one in particular, which I guess was this definition of what the capacity cost index is, because it's really something simple, isn't it? It doesn't seem to be in its terminology, but it is a pretty simple idea, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. And, you know, it's nothing new. This sort of thing has been done in the past in a number of studies, and I just applied it to Indiana. So what we're doing is saying, hey, how much revenue could each county, all the local governments in the county, raise if they used the average tax rates from across the state for average property tax rates, average local income tax rates, and then how much would they receive and do they receive from state school aid formula and the state road aid formula? So that would give you at average rates, if each county behaved in an average way, how much revenue would they raise? And then suppose they delivered an average set of services with average costs to their total population and to the population in cities and towns and to their school enrollment. And suppose they maintained their county and city roads at the average rate, how much would it cost? And so by, you know, doing those calculations, you can compare the revenue that's available at average rate to the cost that must be paid at average levels and see who's got the capacity to pay for an average level of services and who doesn't. And so it's a way of coming up with of this underlying index of fiscal conditions for the 92 counties.
Did you all find that the situation is different for for we'll say urban counties like Lake County and Marion County and Indianapolis and some of the collar counties that are around, which are kind of more urban than they are rural. Then the ones that are growing, which are definitely like the ones around Indianapolis and some places elsewhere in the state. And then you've got your rural counties in general, for example, like Newton County or Jasper County.
Yeah, there were quite stark differences among the counties. One of the things we did was in Indiana was to reduce the capacity of the property tax over the period 2002 to 2018, especially by introducing great big new deductions for homeowners. And of course, the point of this was to reduce property taxes for homeowners. And so, there's reason to do it. But on the other side of the budget, it means that less revenue can be raised in places where there are a lot of homes. Where are there a lot of homes? There are a lot of homes in urban areas. And so it kind of knocked out one of the or at least some of the tax base that urban areas could draw upon. On the other hand, in rural areas, one of the things we did with the reform was to tax farmland at much higher rates. Now, this was quite unfortunate for the farmland owners, I'm inclined to say, given that I work for the College of Agriculture. But as far as the taxes in rural areas, it meant that there was a bigger capacity to draw upon, and it meant that the same services could be provided at lower tax rates in rural areas. And so you had that contrast between what happened in urban areas and what happened in rural areas. And over that period of time, from 2002 to 2018, the capacity cost indexes of rural areas actually improved, and of urban areas generally got worse.
So it sounds like actually the farmers staying put, keeping their land up, and if they can afford to do so, to expand their acreage, seem to come out in the plus column here, as opposed to somebody who lives in town.
Well, the farmers themselves are paying more.
Yeah,
so let's not sneak around that issue there. The reason the capacity has gone up is we gave local governments the ability to tax farmland owners at higher rates. And so we did that, but that obviously increases the capacity of rural governments to raise the revenue. And the change towards market value assessment that began in 2003, and that Lake County played such a big role in, had that impact on the urban and rural counties.
What do we have to look forward to as far as the changes because of lost jobs? In particular, there's some counties I know in the state that have lost a lot of jobs. They may have shifted to other communities, other counties, but they're still considered as lost employment, so that those counties and those local governments aren't getting the revenue back.
Yeah, that was one of the main findings of the study, and it had to do with manufacturing employment. There's a swath of counties running from Kokomo to Richmond, if you think of that area sort of northeast of Indianapolis there, that includes Muncie and as I said, Kokomo and Richmond and places like that, they all had a big negative capacity cost indexes, and those were the places that lost the most manufacturing employment over the long haul between 1972 and 2017. Now, there were a scattering of counties elsewhere that were also in that boat, and one of them was Lake. Mm-hmm. Lake County, of course, was one, and still is, one of the big manufacturing counties in the state. But back in 1972, 40% of Lake's employment was in manufacturing, and now it's 10%. So that's a great big change. And, losing all that manufacturing tax base, both the high-wage job and the assessed value of all that equipment, really put a damper on the capacity of these places to raise revenue. And yet, a place like Lake has so many people, over 90% of the population living in cities and towns, which are higher cost places. And when people live elbow to elbow and shoulder to shoulder, the public service costs are greater. But those cities developed on the foundation of manufacturing employment that just isn't there anymore, and that's one of the sources of Lake's problem and the problem in the what I call the old industrial corridor from Kokomo to Richmond.
We're talking with Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer. Larry and his colleagues have worked together with the Indiana Public Policy, Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, putting out a major report, a look at the tax structure in Indiana, how it seems to compare from county to county. And we're talking in this case between urban counties to counties that are growing very rapidly because of people moving in or businesses moving in, whichever the case may be, I suppose, and rural counties. And now we have the COVID-19 pandemic that seems to be mucking up the works for everybody, it seems. And I know that you and your team had a chance to focus in very seriously on the impact that the recession is having on business and industry and not only and that and residents at all in Indiana, hasn't it?
That's right. And it is beginning to be a serious problem, and it's going to be a very serious problem. If you think about the tax bases that we looked at in this study, property tax, right? It's based on the assessed value of property, and our assessment system now captures declines in property values. And we expect in a recession property values to go down. So for the tax year 2022, we would expect assessed value to be lower, and that will make for either lower spending or higher tax rates. Incomes, of course, will go down. That will also affect local governments in 2022. Will the state be able to maintain full school aid? Governor says yes, and let's hope they do. But that means that the budget that they write next year is probably going to have a smaller increase in school aid than we had hoped for. And state road aid, which is based on motor fuel tax collections, that's already down considerably for local governments. So all of those major revenue sources, and those sources together make up more than 80% of the total revenue of local governments, all of them are down, are going to be down within the next couple of years as a result of the recession. Now, you know, our study is a kind of long-term foundational study, but what it says is that places that have negative capacity cost indexes usually have higher property tax rates. Their property tax rates are likely to rise more as a result of this recession. And under our tax cap credit system, those folks will lose more revenue than will the rural folks to those tax cap credits, which are, of course, attempts to hold property taxes down for local taxpayers.
But I guess for the entire state overall, it's still going to be a very, very rough go for a while for town and city governments just to keep up the basic services, won't it?
Yeah, it really will. And that was true in the last recession, which we call the Great Recession. And, you know, it's certainly possible this recession will be even deeper than that. So, yeah, it's going to be a tough time for all of our local governments.
Now, what does it seem from your estimation, based on the information that you've turned over to the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, that they're going to be able to recommend to the General Assembly? Because we know that a number of changes, as it has happened already, we're talking here about tax caps in the past, and we're talking about changing the school funding formula and a lot of other things, about how the road work in Indiana is paid for these days. And, you know, what's going to happen with lawmakers? How are they going to be advised what they need to do to help keep things going?
That's a good question. And, you know, we didn't make any policy recommendations on this thing. We're simply trying to get the lay of the land in a way. You know, we made these reforms over the last 20 years, and we wanted to step back and say, okay, what do we got? What works? What doesn't work? What causes some places to have positive indexes, to have enough capacity to pay for their services, and what causes other places not to? And I think the study points out a couple of things. And this doesn't mean that anybody's going to make any changes in these things, because there are certainly reasons for their adoption. But we've got a maximum levy, for example, a maximum amount of property taxes that can be raised. And that maximum levy rises by 3 to 4% every year. And what it means is if you're a rapidly growing area, you cannot raise your property tax revenue in proportion to the increase in your population and the increase in your costs. And so rapidly growing areas can have difficulty. We put in these great big deductions for homeowners to hold down their taxes. And, you know, that's a good reason for doing that. But it means that when population grows, the tax base doesn't rise in proportion to the cost. So one of the things I think we pointed out was that our system isn't entirely friendly to places that are actually growing rapidly. But that doesn't mean that it's friendly to places that are declining rapidly either. You know, in a rural area, when a place declines, the costs don't necessarily go down. You still have to maintain all the roads, for example. So you got fewer people paying taxes and just the same mileage of roads to maintain. And so costs per person can actually rise as well in a place where population is going down. Turns out that our system treats places with sort of modest increases in population most favorably.
Well, that shows once again, too, that the rural counties may have a loss of revenue, and you say that the costs of road have to still be maintained because all those folks in the small communities may not have their supermarket open any longer, which means, like, for example, in your case there here in West Central Indiana, that the residents in Benton County have to drive all the way into Tippecanoe County to go shopping. And, you know, the more of those people are going to have to do it, they're going to wear the roads out faster, I suppose.
Well, that's right. You know, just because you don't have as many people, you know, think about it this way. You know, when people move into a county, they tend to create whole new neighborhoods. All right. But when people move out, they move from here and there and here and there. And, you know, you can't simply turn a road back into pasture land because people are still living in all of those places. And so you still got to have roads, at the very least, going from the southern border to the northern border and the eastern border to the western border so people can travel through. So as population declines, road costs don't decline. And yet somebody's got to pay for those roads. So costs per person in declining rural areas tend to rise.
Well, I know somebody will want to take a look in much closer detail to everything that's come about from this in this massive study. How can people find it if they're so interested and they want to check it out in more detail?
It will be linked on the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute website. So if you just search for IFPI there, you will find it.
Well, Professor DeBoer, thank you for spending time again with us and talking about a very important topic. And even though, like I said, the COVID-19 pandemic seems to be getting in the way, but we have the recession, as we all know, has come about because of the pandemic, and it's going to have an impact for some time in one way or the other. It's nice to know what we must face in the future here, and maybe some ideas will be passed along, and maybe lawmakers, if they can make the changes, will do so in the future. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Purdue University Professor Larry DeBoer is working with the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute and working on this analysis of the impact of Indiana's tax structure on urban, growing, and rural counties, as well as the impact that the coronavirus has on all of it. This is Regionally Speaking. July 15th will be the deadline to make sure that your 2019 income tax return is filed. And there's some last-minute tips if you haven't already done so. Maybe you've just waited to file it, but you have the paperwork all done. Maybe not. Well, Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer is with us to bring us up to date on these last-minute tips, I guess you can call them. And, Greg, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
What do you talk in particular to your clients or maybe the person on the street about when they have questions about making sure that their tax returns are ready to go before they have to turn them in?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. Obviously, logistically, you want to make sure you have all the documents, which, given today's environment and the date being pushed back all the way to July 15th, like you mentioned, that's not so much a challenge anymore. But keep in mind that if you're going to look to make an IRA contribution, you do have that extension as well. So understanding getting your return done, obviously, at the last minute, don't forget to take a peek in as to whether or not an IRA contribution might be beneficial for your situation.
We've talked about the question that comes into what individual retirement accounts are all about, and some of these things I know have changed in late because of the change that the CARES Act has brought about. What in particular do you think that we should, maybe, if we haven't done so already, we should know about to make sure that we're going to be all lined up here, not only to get the return in for this year, but to plan for the future?
Yeah, so the CARES Act is going to have a lot more impact for the 2020 return, but in regards to the 2019, one of the unique things that it provided is they suspended required minimum distributions. And for those that turned 70 and a half last year that were waiting to April 1st, they actually could have, you know, foregone their required minimum distribution and not have that at all, even though they were scheduled to take it by April 1st.
We talk about wanting to plan for the not only for the the CARES Act changes that have come about here because of the pandemic, but also, I guess, looking to the future, what would you say that some of the important things that the average person should know about, if they haven't done so already, should be, and when you're looking ahead to what you're going to have to file for your 2020 returns?
Yeah, so the CARES Act, if we specifically talk about that, there's you know, there's a lot of things. There's been a lot of tax changes, actually, in the last couple of years with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Secure Act, and now this CARES Act. The CARES Act has essentially suspended all required minimum distribution requirements from all tax plans, tax advantage plans, whether it be 401Ks, 403Bs, traditional IRAs, even beneficiary IRAs. And the big thing that's interesting with it is if you did take those distributions, not knowing that they were going to be waived, the IRS has actually offered relief all the way through August 31st. You can put those distributions, those required minimum distributions that you took out, back into your retirement account if you wish, and basically negate the event as if it never occurred.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting situation that the only pandemic seems to have been able to create, huh?
Yes, yes. And then early withdrawals. So there used to be a lot of things with tax advantage plans that if you took an early withdrawal, you'd be subject to a 10% IRS penalty when you filed your taxes, a lot of times mandatory tax withholdings. But they have allowed early withdrawals if you met certain criteria. Mm-hmm. And it has to be specific, but you could have actually withdrawn up to $100,000 early without penalty if you were diagnosed with the COVID-19 or had a dependent or spouse diagnosed with the COVID-19 or if you experienced a financial hardship as a direct result, like you were laid off, quarantined, had a reduction in work hours. So a pretty significant change in the tax code.
We've talked about this before when this all came about early on and the CARES Act went into effect, the fact that not only could you take advantage of it for your tax purposes are concerned, but also if you needed to borrow money from your own retirement account, that you could do so. But, of course, you still have to pay yourself back in this respect. What's the situation that we should be aware of here about repayment?
Yeah, so that's the nice thing with this program. And keep in mind, this is for even in the future if you know somebody that has a situation where they're diagnosed or hardships. The nice thing about it is not only do you avoid the 10% penalty, but you have redeposit opportunities. You'd have up to 3 years that you can actually repay those plans and have zero tax liability, or they would give you up to 3 years to actually pay the tax liability on the portion of the withdrawal that isn't redeposited. So not only is there no mandatory withholdings, but you could potentially pay back after time and avoid the tax implication altogether.
Well, as far as these loans are concerned, since you have this opportunity to stretch things out and pay your retirement plan back from what you had to borrow for the time being, are we finding that many people have taken, from what you know, many people taken advantage of this option?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really understand now because of, you know, just the situation with the COVID, obviously, and I'm sure a lot of this information, Chris, will come to us as the year progresses.
Right.
But in addition to being able to take these withdrawals, to your point, the loans have actually, they've doubled the limit on even loans in certain tax advantages. So you could take the distribution if you had a COVID situation, but if you didn't, the CARES Act actually doubled the limit for loan provisions on your retirement plans. So it's up to $100,000 where it used to be $50,000, and they have the opportunity to suspend payments if they had current loans or they took these loans out under the CARES Act of 2020, extending the term to 6 years instead of the typical five. So even if you didn't have the COVID, you had an opportunity to borrow from your plans that you didn't before.
Now, in your particular line of business, you have an opportunity to not only talk to clients and the citizens as well, but people just have general questions. Have you had a lot of questions in particular from your clients having to take advantage of all of this that's been available under the CARES Act?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the CARES Act, you know, is just now the information starting to get out to people. I think what's been nice with it, Chris, is a lot of people didn't realize the benefits were forced into, you know, coming to us and asking us, hey, how can I get money? You know, they didn't realize those opportunities exist. So I think the actual opportunity within the CARES Act will become more relevant as the word gets out. But there's a lot of opportunity for people to help resolve financial issues that just weren't there before.
Do you get the impression that this is all going to make a lot of difference when it's time to get your returns filed for next year to get lined up here, or will some of this kind of fall in place?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be critical that whoever's doing your taxes understands it, right? Because you have 3 years to repay. You have 3 years to defer the taxes. So, you know, filing is going to be a little bit more different for those that, you know, acted under these provisions than just straightforward, you know, getting a 1099. So it'll be interesting even for us to understand exactly how they're going to report all of these documents. But you want somebody to understand that the reporting, you know, it's not necessarily, it's going to be unusual, right? It's the first time that reporting could be done in the first year, second year, or third year, or potentially not at all, which is kind of crazy.
Well, we'll see what happens when it's time to work on the returns for next year, to be sure. And, Greg, thanks for being with us to talk about this.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Back in June, voters in Union Township, which is in Porter County, not far from Valparaiso, had a chance to decide whether they wanted to continue what had been previously approved for the school district as some operating cost extensions, basically. Let's find out more about that, because voters agreed this time around back in the June primary election to go along with it. We have with us Superintendent of the Union Township Schools, John Hunter, with us. And Superintendent Hunter, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for hosting. Appreciate it.
Will you do me a favor and tell us more detail what this original idea was that had been approved, I guess, several years ago, but was up for extension, for renewal, however you want to put it, this time around?
Yes. Back in 2013, we took a voter question to our taxpayers requesting a 22-cent per $100 of assessed valuation increase in order to fund the operating of our schools, and that passed at about 58% to 42%, and that was good for 7 years, according to statute.
Right.
So we were at the end of that 7 years, and so we had the opportunity to either go back to our taxpayers again to renew that or to go forward without those extra dollars, and we decided that we needed to move forward with taking that to our voters, being cognizant of what our taxpayers are paying on a daily basis. We did lower our tax to 21 cents, so even though it was just a penny, it does save our taxpayers some money. In addition to that, we had some debt that was retiring, and so our taxpayers will really still see a decrease in the amount of taxes that they will pay in 2021 as compared to 2019. And so we felt that was important. We wanted to get that message out, and our taxpayers supported that idea overwhelmingly. We had a victory of 81% to 19%, and that is that serves as one of the largest margins in Indiana currently.
Well, that has to be, to say the least. Now, for our listeners that are in Lake County and maybe in LaPorte County and some of the other counties not in Porter County that are not familiar with the Union Township School Corporation, tell us about the district, the number of schools, number of teachers, and number of students that attend classes, and how important it is to have gotten the referendum first passed and now extended this time around.
Union Township is a one township school corporation. It serves just only Union Township residents in Porter County, which is located on the western border, just below Portage. So we kind of sit between Portage, Hobart, Merrillville, and then we also have Porter Township just to our south, and Valparaiso to our east. And so we have about 1,470 students on our ADM as of last year. We are in an area where we are having declining enrollment, primarily because our houses had not flipped. Now, we do have some of our subdivisions that are just now beginning to flip, so I do believe we will see an increase in our enrollment from this point on for at least a little bit. We have about 100 teachers, 100 support staff. We have two elementaries, one middle school, and one high school, and our high school being Wheeler High School.
Now, I get the impression that because you talk important, it's important to note, of course, that the number of houses that happen to be in a district where folks live and have youngsters that go to school, and you say about a lot of those houses are probably along in years. They're not new houses, to be sure, but as a result, they probably have a number of residents that have youngsters that have been in school in Union Township schools, but they've graduated and they've gone on, and so they're probably, I guess, due to be reoccupied with newer families. And you mentioned probably some newer subdivisions that are coming into the area too, right?
Sure. Well, we do have Sagamore, which is one of our newest one, and we have Arbor Lakes, which is also one of our newer subdivisions, but those are many much smaller subdivisions when you compare those to Shorewood. And Shorewood basically had been an older community, and so we are beginning to see houses in Shorewood flip over. Residents are now moving on to more of a retirement type of home, and newer families are, or younger families are, buying those homes. So that's good for our enrollment. We believe that we will see an increase this year based on what we're seeing in terms of the number of houses being sold.
Back in 2014, when the first referendum was approved and was in turn put into effect, was there a problem, or did you folks and the school board in particular foresee a problem that was going to happen here? I'm sure a lot to do with the fact that the property tax caps are being lifted more than anything else, right?
What affected us the most, Chris, was mm-hmm. the change in the way that schools are funded from the state level. Back in 2008, the Indiana legislature changed that from more of a property tax model to a model where the state was going to fund our general fund at that time. And so that all fluctuates based on the economy. So when the economy is weaker, which it took a downturn in 2009, 2010, then the state does not have those dollars to support our schools. Whereas if we had stayed with property tax is a more stable tax, and so schools could better rely on stable funding, because most people will pay their property taxes. So so that was part of it. And then in of course 2010, Governor Daniels sent out a message in December, and Union Township had to cut $300,000 from our budget in December, which was certainly a negative impact for us. We had to reduce the number of teachers we had, increase class sizes, and so over time we knew that if we were going to get back to where we were going to have additional funding from our taxpayers, and so that's the reason we primarily went to the referendum vote the first time.
We're talking with John Hunter. He's the superintendent of the Union Township Schools in Porter County, and as I mentioned, it's kind of nestled in between Hobart and Lake County, here in this case, as well as Valparaiso and Portage in Porter County. They, in turn, have joined now the township schools in South Lake County, the Hanover Community Schools, and having a successful referendum, as happened back in June. Tell us a little bit about the campaign. Since you already had this in place, of course, from 2014, was anything different this time around in asking the supporters of the school district to go along for an extension?
Well, we did take a little bit of a different approach this time. What we looked at, because we had the benefit of knowing where our voter support was in 2013, mm-hmm. we started with that information, and we, of course, went out to our precincts and tried to get some stability from those supporters that supported us the last time. But then we also went out to try to educate those that in those areas that did not support us the last time, in trying to gain support. And so we initially sent out a newsletter article in January to educate our people about it. And then we were starting a door-to-door campaign, but then with COVID-19, obviously we had to change our plan there. So yeah. Instead of doing door hangers and going door-to-door, we decided to do an additional flyer with that information and mailed that to all of our households. And then our teachers and some of our other staff really came through in starting a phone call campaign in the last 2 weeks prior to the referendum actual vote on June 2nd, and we believe that that helped us a lot. And then, of course, we were at the polls on June 2nd trying to rally our voters.
I know some school districts that go for referenda, they use marketing tools if they can, because I guess in a way it is kind of like a business marketing, and although a little different because it's for educational purposes. Was there anything different that you found when you did your, especially when you did your flyers that went out in the mail, as to asking people to not only to continue to support this, but try to persuade those maybe who remember the first time around that maybe they need to change their mind and help out?
Yes, but Chris, I would liken it to more of a political campaign, more so than a business marketing strategy. But yeah, we certainly did educate them as to what the need was, and if, and more so if it didn't pass, what the consequences were going to be, and in terms of, you know, we were going to have to cut $1.4 million out of our budget, and that touches a lot of programs, and not good for kids.
Well, you're not the first person I've talked to about referenda that liken it to a political campaign. A lot of people and a lot of school districts I know do that, and they do have, in some cases, if they feel they need it, the professional help, people that are out there that actually, as part of their regular job, is to help school districts get successful referendum. Did you go that route, or did you all feel that that you had, were off on the right track with the mailers and the like?
Well, we tried to do it ourselves.
Uh-huh.
We really didn't feel like it was prudent or responsible for us to spend taxpayer dollars to hire a firm, and we felt like we could do it before. We kind of mirrored the same strategy that we did the last time, and so we kind of knew what we were going to do. So we really didn't have to tap into that. We've been to several seminars and heard some of those people speak, so we just tried to emulate some of the ideas that they offer at those workshops.
Well, that's the idea, is to figure out what these guys do and not have to pay for it through the professional fees that they charge. And we know that's their job, so we can understand that. Well, let me ask you now, Superintendent Hunter, as we finish up the summer months and get ready for what we hope will be, although certainly a very much changed 2020-2021 school year, how do things look for the Union Township schools in reopening?
Well, at this point in time, we do have a plan that our board considered last week, and we have sent that out to our families, and we are putting together a frequently asked questions page based on comments that we're getting back from our parents, and we'll be sending that out. So at this point in time, obviously it's a day-to-day. It really is going to be dependent upon what the Porter County Health Department tells us in terms of whether or not we'll be able to open. But at this point in time, we are planning to open. We will also have a virtual component for those families who are not quite ready to send their kids back into the school. We understand that, but it's important to us that we not lose those students, and so we are going to provide some kind of a virtual program for them.
Now, I know that some school districts have problems in that respect, especially rural school districts, although you're lucky you're in between communities, so you probably have a much stronger Wi-Fi system or what's out there. There's not so much the digital divide that I know, as they call it, that exists between families and their school districts, in this case, trying to be able to do online learning. Do you think that there are any problems? Have they all been worked out that you feel that it's going to be strong to be able to do that this time?
Well, we do believe that we'll be able to pull it off. We do have a few families who struggle with connectivity, and we're aware of that. We did not really hear of that so much in the spring. We've heard some of that this summer. So we know where those pockets are, and we're trying to resolve those issues so that whether we're going to use individual hotspots or whether we're going to work with providers, but we are going to try to meet the needs of those kids because we believe that that's important.
Well, Superintendent Hunter, thank you for all the great information today. Congratulations to you and everybody in the Union Township Schools and the staff and the board members for the successful extension of the referendum that will continue to get the support in to keep the schools open, operating, the teachers taken care of, and the youngsters educated. And we thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I also obviously could not do it alone. I thank the committee that helped us with it, and certainly the taxpayers who supported it, because without their support, we would be in a much different situation.
That's true. They all deserve the credit, to be sure. Thank you very much. John Hunter is the superintendent of the Union Township Schools in Porter County. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a conversation with Dr. Paige McNulty, who is the Gary Community School Corporation Emergency Manager, about the official plan to reopen the Gary Community Schools this fall. Hope you'll join us.